Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. Serving the community for over 75 years, Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to reducing hospital-acquired infections and readmission rates. More information on UPMC Pinnacle's achievements in patient safety can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/quality.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. There were 38 murders committed with guns in York County between 2013 and 2016. 21 of those homicides were or allegedly committed by people who were not allowed to legally possess a firearm. So how did the perpetrators get the guns used in the crimes, and what can be done about it? The York Daily Record is publishing a series this week that investigates guns in the hands of those who shouldn't legally have them. Our guest today is the investigative reporter who wrote those stories. Ed Mann joins us from the York Daily Record. Ed, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Ed, I have to say that that statistic, 38 murders, 21 committed by those who legally were not allowed to possess a gun, that's an alarming statistic.
It is. And it's at least 21. I mean, there could be, we started out looking at all the gun homicides in York County over a three-year period. We started with about 59, and then we didn't analyze ones there was no suspect name or if it was a law enforcement homicide. So then we ended up with a list of 38 homicides, and then we went through them. We looked at criminal records in Pennsylvania, elsewhere, looked at if somebody had a final protection order against that person, that would ban them from having a gun, certain other offenses. And yeah, we found at least 21 cases where at least one of the people who was charged with or accused of the shooting wasn't allowed to have a gun to begin with.
Just wanted to correct something. You said law enforcement homicide. You mean law enforcement shooter.
Yeah, law enforcement shooter, yeah. So and I think they were all ruled justifiable in York County, but if the law enforcement officer was a shooter, then they were obviously allowed to have the gun. So
what are the reasons that a person would be banned from possessing a gun?
So some of the big ones is a felony conviction. That's been under federal law, that makes you banned from having a gun for decades. If you commit a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, so like a simple assault against your wife, that also comes with a lifetime ban for possessing a firearm. Certain misdemeanor offenses, if they're punishable by more than 2 years in prison, that'll make you banned under federal law from possessing a firearm. And the other big one is if protected from abuse order, if your husband or wife gets a PFA order against you, a final PFA order, even if a judge doesn't order you to give up weapons, you're still banned from possessing them while that order is in effect.
So the big question is, how are these people getting guns then?
So, you know, we looked at it and there's sort of like, I would say two big picture ways. One is in our reporting, we found the majority of those homicides with an illegally possessed gun happened in New York City. And the situation in New York City is what people there are saying, the mayor, other elected officials, police, you know, say there, and DA's office, is that the guns are just so they're basically being sold on the street. And there's instances of a 14-year-old getting a gun, shooting someone, and when he was asked about it, he just said he bought it off the street for about $180.
And the judge asked, how's a 14-year-old get $180?
And he said, doing stuff I wasn't supposed to be doing. So in New York City, the situation that judges and others describe is just, there are just guns, people are bringing them in for profit, and they can sell them out of the trunk of their car or that kind of thing. And then you have other cases outside of New York City. One of the cases we focused on was in a rural Fawn Township murder or alleged double homicide, double murder. In that case, the people accused in that crime are Paul Henry and Veronique Henry. Both of them had prior criminal histories that would ban them from possessing firearms. And in that case, we looked at whether there were opportunities to seize guns from them that weren't taken.
Well, let's talk about that case because you.
When I said, I said alleged murders, I mean that they haven't been convicted. Nobody's been convicted yet.
And we will. Everyone, we have to add that is considered innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. Hence the word alleged. But I'm going to ask you because you provided a number of examples throughout your stories of where someone was killed by someone else, where allegedly by someone else using a gun that they were not supposed to have in the first place. But since you brought up that case, that was, as you, I think you described it in your story, as maybe the perfect example of what goes wrong. Talk about the victims in that case, Fode Cheeks and Danielle Taylor. And as you mentioned, the alleged murderers are Paul Henry and Veronique Henry.
And so about a year ago, September of last year, it was a night, Fode Cheeks, he was playing Mortal Kombat with some teenagers in his house. Danielle Taylor was making a hamburgers in the kitchen. And then police say two robbers showed up. One of them shot Fode Cheeks right away, multiple times. They found prosecutors and examiners found him with 8 gunshot wounds. And then the robbers robbed the place. They held others up at gunpoint. They took cell phones, wallet. State police say they were looking for drugs or looking for money from the sale of drugs. And then by the end, they also shot Danielle Taylor. The next, 13 hours later, police arrested Paul Henry and Veronique Henry as the suspects in that case. And so Paul Henry, he had, and Veronique Henry, they had criminal records. Paul Henry, years ago, he had been convicted of a misdemeanor of simple assault. It was a misdemeanor of domestic violence, which meant that he was banned from possessing firearms. And Veronique had felony convictions that would make her banned from possessing firearms. And when police arrested them, they said they found 3 handguns in the trunk of their car.
Were handguns used in the murders?
There were we don't know those. We don't know the handguns that were, if those handguns were the police and prosecutors haven't said whether those handguns match with what was used. But yeah, I mean guns were used in the,
right,
in the killings.
But obviously, the bottom line is that they were not supposed. Neither one was supposed to be in possession of a firearm legally, mm-hmm. and there were 3 guns found. As far as the murder goes, and this was a robbery, as you said, mm-hmm. I mean, did the victims know the Henrys?
You know, it was a little unclear in the, I think, so Fode Cheeks, he had been at the time, he was on bail on heroin delivery charges, so he was an alleged heroin dealer. And so I think I think prosecutors and or police in their warrant, one of the victims who survived in Fawn Township, I think, recognized Veronique. I don't think they recognized Paul. So there was some loose connection, but it's not clear based on the exact relationship.
So you mentioned a couple of the crimes, but I mean, from what you describe in your story, I mean, these were pretty serious crimes and pretty extensive list.
Yeah, and so so with Paul Henry, there, you know, you can what we do in the story is walk through times when he first got banned, which was for a misdemeanor of simple assault against his wife back in the early 2000s. And then there were multiple times where he almost got in trouble for being too close to guns. I think it was in 2012, he was on probation, and probation officer showed up to his home, and he lived at the same property as his mother, who had guns, and he wasn't allowed to have access to guns. And he was initially charged with a probation violation for being on that same property and refusing to leave the property and refusing to get the guns off the property. That got resolved. It's not clear how. Henry's attorney, Farley Holt, who was his attorney at the time as well, said that because there are separate residences, structures, that's why it was able to be resolved.
But let me stop you for just a moment there. I mean, let's back up just a moment. So this guy is living in the home with his mother. Now, he's ordered that he's not supposed to be around guns, period. But the mother, who I understand from your story was an avid hunter, mm-hmm. had guns. There are 2 different ways to look at that. One is, okay, so should her guns have been confiscated? The guy should he have been ordered to move out? But then you know, she's being punished for a crime that her son commits. I guess that's the argument against it. So just kind of walk us through that scenario.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's complicated. It's something the probation department, you know, in other cases, they say it's a very unpopular course of action because you have Paul Henry. He's on probation, and he's not allowed to be own, possess, or control a gun as a standard condition of probation. And because of his past conviction, he's not allowed to have a gun anyway. But his mother, who's, you know, done nothing wrong, they live on the same property. What the Henrys say is that they're separate entrances. You know, it's like
it's a duplex.
Or, you know, it's been split up somehow.
Okay.
And so, like, it's been split up because they both live there. But they come in different ways. And so what the probation department is, it's what they were saying is, it's in this case, it wasn't clear if he actually had access to the guns. You know, did he actually have any other way into his mother's home? And so that's the conflict. I mean, he sent me a letter from jail saying that it's totally separate. They're in a safe. He doesn't have access to them. And so that's a conflict that comes up in this case, and it comes up in other cases.
Well, okay, let's talk about other cases aside from the, but that scenario. Go ahead.
And it just and so but so what happened with that case though is, like, 2 years later in 2014, Paul Henry is driving, gets in a vehicle accident, and then police respond to the scene, or they were already following him when he crashed, and then they found a loaded revolver in the vehicle. And he tells police that he didn't know it was there, and that it was his mother's, and that she had left it there. And then so he was charged with illegally possessing a firearm and other charges, but the case was dropped by the DA's office. And the chief of police there said that the mother was willing to testify that she had left it there without his knowledge. So that's a case of that's the gray area that gets created when you share a residence or share items with somebody who is allowed to have a gun and you're not.
Who did the vehicle belong to that he was driving?
I have it in my notes somewhere. See, but I can't speak to it right now.
I would think that would be a pretty big part of it, because if both his mother and he had access to that vehicle, okay, you know, maybe that could be a reasonable explanation, although I still think that, I'm not a judge and I don't make those decisions, but that still seems like he is in possession, whether it was his fault or not. But if it was his vehicle and the gun was in the car, anyway, yeah, that'd be aside.
And then pretty much the same time, around the same time, his Veronique applied for a temporary PFA against him, received it, and a judge ordered him to give up firearms. But they weren't taken because the same situation happened. The mother said that they aren't his guns. They're my guns, and he doesn't have access to them.
We're going to talk about the reasons that, and some of the things that the Daily Record uncovered, some of the reasons that these people were able to get these guns illegally in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by the team of cardiologists, surgeons, nurses, physicians assistants, and rehabilitation specialists from Pinnacle Health Cardiovascular Institute, part of UPMC Pinnacle, delivering a broad range of traditional and highly specialized procedures.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Ed Mann, an investigative reporter with the York Daily Record, which has published a three-part series this week on guns used by those possessing them illegally. First part ran in yesterday's paper, second part today, and the third part tomorrow. You can also read those stories online, and these are very well-investigated, very well-written stories, and I think that you'll learn a lot. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk@witf. Again, that's 1-800-729-7532. Ed, so as I said, you investigated this, and one of the questions I'm sure many people have, especially after just hearing about the incidents that you described, what are some of the reasons that this occurs, that these people are able to get their hands on a gun when they're not supposed to have them.
Yeah, and so one of the key things is the gray area we mentioned of the family member having access to a gun. That can create complications for police and probation officers. But you know, big picture-wise, there's no consistent system in Pennsylvania for after someone gets convicted of a crime that means they aren't allowed to possess a gun to really ensure that they give up those guns. You know, they become banned from having guns, but there's no consistent system for making sure they give it up. And state police do have records of certain handgun sales, transactions. If I bought a handgun at a firearms dealer, state police would know that. But if, you know, a few years from now I get convicted of something that makes me ineligible to possess a gun, there are multiple ways I could get rid of that gun that state police wouldn't know about. So they wouldn't know for sure if I still had a gun or not. And which happened in Veronique's case. So after she was identified as a suspect, state police looked up records and they saw that she had, I believe it was registered or their database showed that she had at some point owned or been given 4 guns, but it wasn't clear whether she was indeed an owner at the time of the shootings, and based on the records that they have.
I keep, you know, one of the things that strikes me about what you're talking about is you if you use the phrase "it's not clear" or the phrase "it's not clear," it sounds like there are a lot of gray areas, or there are a lot of things that either law enforcement hasn't followed through with, or that it just hasn't come to completion.
Well, if you look at the handgun records, I mean that's controversial in gun communities. So there are people who, you know, pro Second Amendment people, however they want to describe themselves, but they think that handgun registry. Or they think it's a registry, and they think it's not just a record of sales. They think it goes further and amounts to tracking everybody who owns a handgun, and they think that's infringing on privacy rights. They think that's infringing on the Second Amendment rights. And so that was actually, the state police have had this database of sales for a year. I mean, it's going back decades. But it actually survived a court challenge like in the mid-early 2000s. So there's a reason. I mean, so part of it is, and there are some state lawmakers who want to get rid of that database they already have, who already say it goes too far. So there's a limit to what I guess lawmakers want them to be able to track.
Well, and anytime the subject of guns comes up, I think one of the reasons that I found your story so fascinating and eye-opening is that this is such a controversial issue anytime there are guns involved. You say gun, you're going to have one side going to say all guns are bad, you know, register, take them away, do whatever. Then you have the other side that we say, see, that's what we have a Second Amendment right. We have a constitutional right to possess firearms legally. We do it for self-protection. We do it for hunting. We do it for sport, whatever. And these people over here can't see it. This is an area where, when it comes down to it, people have been killed, obviously, because you can't get people to agree on when, you know, you hear the term common sense gun laws. You can't get people to agree.
Yeah. And one of the reactions to, you know, our stories that we did, and we anticipated it too, but when we say that, you know, that more than half the killings, half of the gun shooting deaths in York County that we were able to track, somebody had an illegally possessed gun. The one answer to that is like gun laws are never going to work or never going to stop that. The only answer is for other people to be armed as well. So that's sort of I think people can look at these same set of facts and draw their own conclusions.
Well, because it's a great example of an issue in which this country is divided on a whole lot. But along those lines, what you just mentioned, isn't there a legislator who proposed reducing the amount of time that someone who has filed for a PFA could actually get a permit for a gun for protection?
That's been in some other states. That's been so in some other states, the idea is that if someone applies for a protection order and gets it, then they don't have to wait as long to get a gun permit. Essentially, that would essentially be their initial approval.
So a gun to protect
themselves.
The person who the PFA has been fouled against. All right, so there are some other laws that have been proposed over the years. One that we hear about most often, a number of cities across Pennsylvania did this and were taken to court, and you know, it's actually been proposed in on the statewide level too, and that is a requirement that all guns that are lost or stolen would be required to be reported. What about that?
Yeah, so that's an idea that was proposed in New York City as well in 2009. It was proposed in New York City. It's the idea that within 72 hours, if someone loses or has a gun stolen, once they become aware of that, they have to report it to law enforcement. And the argument for that is that it would help identify straw purchasers. It would help these
straw purchasers. Explain what a straw
purchaser is. Yeah, so straw purchasers is if someone who is legally allowed to buy a gun, just goes to a gun store, buys it, and then just sells it to someone who isn't allowed to possess one. And you can, they can do that for profit. They can make good money doing that, I guess. And so part of the issue is, and so in some of these cases, in one of the cases we talked about, domestic, it was a murder-suicide case in Fairview Township. There was Carrie Staley was killed a few years ago. Her killer was not allowed to possess a gun. Police traced the gun back to Texas, but that gun was never reported lost or stolen, so they don't know for sure how the killer got the gun. And that's the idea behind some of these reporting requirement laws, is that it would make it easier to identify the chain of how guns fall into these hands.
And the argument against it you hear most often is that, in the cases where cities like York, Lancaster, Harrisburg have all enacted or at one time or another, discussed having this requirement that lost or stolen guns would have to be reported, is that the laws across the state wouldn't be uniform. Mm-hmm. Then, that you have a gun owner wouldn't know, depending on where they live, they may be unknown. And state law says that you have to have uniform laws that way. So that's one of the big arguments against it. And plus, just a couple years ago, the state legislature enacted a bill that would allow even outside the state, organizations to sue municipalities that had laws like that.
Yeah, to block them. And in 2009, New York City was one of the cities that they thought about doing this law, but they were afraid of the possibility of a lawsuit. So they didn't pass it. So they don't have that law in the books. But many municipalities did do it. And then, a few years ago, like you said, the state legislature made it easier for outside groups to preemptively block these laws. That got overturned in court, basically on procedural grounds. And now some lawmakers are trying to reintroduce that. And they say that when these laws aren't uniform, that the law-abiding people are going to follow them, and the people who aren't going to follow laws aren't going to, they're going to break the laws anyway. So the law-abiding people won't have the same protections.
Let's take a call from Rob in Lancaster. Rob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. You said a few minutes ago, and I know you put it in inverted commas, the idea of common sense gun law.
Yes.
I grew up in New Zealand, and it's actually illegal to own a handgun. It's a very different scenario, very different environment, obviously. Virtually every home in rural New Zealand, though, has like a shotgun or a rifle of some kind behind the door. It's just, I guess, to me, the question is more around the common sense thing. The challenge facing our society doesn't feel like it's the gun issue. Like, I totally agree with the comment that was just made that, unfortunately, you put laws in place. The simple truth is it's much like amnesties, gun amnesties. If you ask people to bring their guns in that, they're illegal guns, the guys who own illegal guns are not going to bring them in.
No.
That's the whole point of why they own them illegally.
Right, right.
So it's the legal guys that suffer. I guess the challenge I always have is with the gun rights advocates is I guess the deepest question is, what is their major concern? Is it more this whole thing of, the government can't take our guns away because at the end of the day, we have Second Amendment that protects our right to gather as a militia should the government, force us into things that we don't agree with? Or is it, the challenge with that whole argument is, at the end of the day, if the military or if the government rises up to a point where that's the case, are they not going to bring excessive force to the door anyway? So what likelihood is there going to be that you as an individual are going to have the ability to stand against that? I mean, that's where I'm struggling a little bit. It's like, in terms of being a legal owner of a gun in this country, is it not that your right is protected to own it, but at the same time to have it registered is not really hurting anyone? I mean, there does seem to be a bit of a paranoia about the government rising up and trying to take them away. Mm.
I think you have some of the same questions that people for 200 years have had. Hey, Rob, thank you very much for your call. But, you know, one of the points that he makes, and it goes back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, when I think I used the words common sense. He's right. Most people, when it comes to this issue, can't even agree on what's common sense. Mm-hmm. I guess where I was going with it is that someone who owns a gun or possesses a gun illegally, it would be common sense that something more would be done, that there would be laws in place, stronger laws, ways to confiscate those guns from someone who has them illegally. I don't think that even, put it this way, I shouldn't speak that way. I would think that most people who label themselves as pro-Second Amendment gun rights people would agree that they don't want people who are not supposed to have guns to have them. It makes them all look bad. They're all painted with that broad brush then. All right, so let's get back to some of the other things that... Go ahead.
I talked to, Firearms Owners Against Crime. It's a statewide group.
Yes.
I talked to them, and they talked to their president, and they think that the use of these legally possessed guns and homicides underscores the fact that law-abiding people don't go into a gun store, with the idea of killing somebody, the next day or anything like that. But that it's the issue of many of these people had prior criminal records that they think it underscores the fact that they should have been. It's up to the court system to keep these people off the streets for longer. The argument they make is that most people who are doing killings, doing these shootings, it's relative, it's during a certain period of time that people are more likely to do that. And so if they've committed previous crimes, and especially previous gun crimes, that they should be in jail longer or prison longer.
We already have laws in place that if a crime is committed with a gun, if I remember correctly, it's like in Pennsylvania, it's like an automatic 5-year extension, right?
I'm not positive what the actual... I'm not sure about...
I think there is. I think there are... A lot of times there are pleas and...
There are plea agreements and there are... And that's the case that they make, is that the prosecutor just drops these charges as part of larger cases.
Something else that has happened that you report on is that guns that actually have been ordered confiscated mm-hmm. by the courts weren't relinquished. Why?
And so, in Paul Henry's case... he was ordered to give up guns. It was part of a temporary protection from abuse order that was ordered against him. And sheriff's deputy went to his home, and they ran into the issue that his mother, according to the sheriff, said that they're not his guns, even though the woman said that he had access or control or possession of these guns. She was wrong, and he doesn't have access to these guns. And sheriff's deputies, they don't have authority under Pennsylvania law to search someone's home after a PFA order to ensure compliance, to ensure that they truly don't have access to guns.
It sounds as if, how do I put it? It sounds as if there are a lot of loopholes. I mean, we call it gray areas, but it mm-hmm. sounds like there's a lot of loopholes, and that sometimes that even the police or the sheriff in this case, that sometimes they don't know what to do.
Well, I guess, so I talked to the sheriff, and he thinks they did what they're allowed to do under the law in this case. And the law does not allow, like, there have been changes, proposals to change state law to give sheriffs the authority to allow judges to order sheriffs to go into people's homes to ensure compliance with these gun relinquishment.
They can do that now if they get a warrant, right?
Yeah, if they get a warrant, but establishing that probable cause for the warrant is an additional hurdle.
Do they do that? I mean, has it occurred
for PFA orders? I guess I'm not aware of that being a routine thing, but I have not. It's not something I can say definitively.
We know that there is legislation now in Harrisburg that require all those who have had PFAs. against them to give up their firearms. Where does that stand?
So that there's been Senator Tom Kelly, and he proposed that it would apply to anybody with a final PFA order. So more than just like there's like two stages.
A temporary, temporary
is like in a temporary order, the defendant doesn't get a chance to defend himself, but in a final PFA order, the defendant does get a chance. And so Senator Killian's argument is that if they get a final PFA order, that's been established by a judge that they present some risk. And so they should lose the gun rights too. And that's under federal law. They're not allowed to have guns as well. But this would be established in state law to make sure they lose it. That hasn't come up for any votes or committee hearings yet. There's been some advocacy for it. But and even when it was proposed, there was a news conference with like multiple Republican lawmakers proposing domestic violence legislation. And two of the people on that stage had concerns about that piece.
What kind of concerns?
Well, one of the senators said that she was worried about false PFA, someone so that it could be potentially used against the true victim in a case, so that someone could allege that they had been abused as a way of making someone they were actually abusing give up guns.
How often does that happen?
I don't know of any stats on how often that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah. I've talked to domestic violence advocates, and it happens very rarely. Plus, you have a judge there who has to see probable cause to issue that PFA,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's true. That's true. I think one of the arguments is that people who are defendants in PFA cases, sometimes they'll just agree to it as a way of settling it somewhat amicably, as opposed to because they're afraid of the worst consequences with it.
Well, then one of the things to consider is whether you have guns, you're going to realize that's going to have to be given up anyway.
That's just
part of the legislation. As I mentioned earlier, you provide a number of examples of where murders were committed or allegedly committed by someone who was not allowed to possess a firearm legally. A couple other cases I wanted to talk to you about. Jessica Mellinger. She was shot and killed allegedly by John Snyder.
Yeah, John,
tell us about that case.
So John Snyder, years ago, he had been convicted of his second DUI, and there was marijuana involved, and then he ended up pleading guilty to DUI, misdemeanor of the first degree, which is a jargony term, but it basically meant he could have gone to prison for up to 5 years. That's probably pretty rare for DUI cases, but under federal law, that means if you're convicted of a misdemeanor that can go longer than 2 years, you're not allowed to possess guns forever. And I talked to a DUI attorney, Second Amendment attorney, and other attorneys, and they said that it's not well known that provision that if you have a DUI, certain DUI convictions mean you're not allowed to possess guns. But in John Snyder's case, he was on probation as well under the supervision of the probation department, and they told him he couldn't have access to guns. But they let him live in the same home as at least one other, as someone who did have access to guns, or at least one other gun. And then so in January 2014, he broke into a locked cabinet. He took out a shotgun. He shot Jessica Mellinger. He fired, and then he had a standoff with police. He fired at police officers. And then after a long standoff, he killed himself.
Now, breaking into a locked cabinet, basically he stole a gun.
He stole a gun, yeah. So that's what police said, he stole a gun. But, I mean, he stole a gun in the same home where he lived.
So the question comes down to whether he should have actually been in that home if there were guns in the home.
Yeah, and so the probation department allowed him to – we were talking about the Henry case earlier. That was an instance that Henry said the probation department said, you have to get off this property. But in John Snyder's case, they allowed him to live on the property, but they just said he couldn't have access to the guns. What some of the factors they consider on that is the severity, how serious the previous charges were. First degree misdemeanor DUI is not on the scale that, like, it's not a violent crime. So that's one factor.
Let's take a call from Scott in Millersburg. Scott, you're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to comment on the availability of guns, and I want to ask a question. What's the penalty for a first-time offender for owning an illegal gun?
I'm not positive.
Well, that seems like to be a big issue. If that was increased drastically, I think that would be a real good step in the right direction of correcting the problem.
And that's pretty much what, and you mentioned Kim Stauffer of a gun rights group and talked about increasing the penalties for illegally possessing a gun.
Yeah, and the point Kim Stauffer raised is that he says it's often if someone is convicted of charged with multiple crimes, sometimes the gun issue is dropped as part of a plea agreement or the sentence, or the prosecutors don't ask for a certain sentence.
So, Scott, what was your other part of your comment?
Well, I'm going to change that. I want to say that, it seems like it's a joke to these kids and people that have these guns illegally. And no more plea agreements on that. When it comes to guns, there should be no plea agreements because it's a very, very serious problem.
Hmm. Hey, thank you very much for your call. There would probably be a lot of people who would agree with that, and I'm sure that's something that prosecutors do take into account, but there are other factors that they're weighing as well. So, Ed, we're almost out of time for this portion of the show. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I want to mention again that series is in the York Daily Record, started yesterday, today's edition of the paper, and tomorrow as well. So just to kind of summarize, what we're looking at in many cases is gray area, sometimes not follow through, sometimes just people that are not who are helping someone possess a gun that shouldn't be helping a gun. Sounds like there's a lot to deal with here.
Yeah, there is. It's a complicated issue because you're weighing rights, essentially. I mean, you're weighing the rights of privacy rights, Second Amendment rights, and the rights. I mean, people lose rights when they're involved in some criminal proceedings, but it's a question of how, not just how much rights do they lose, but how active are you enforcing? How actively are you enforcing the loss of those rights? Mm.
Ed Mann, New York Daily Record, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And you also, if you're outside the York area where you can't get a copy of the newspaper, that series is online as well. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico last week, knocking out power on the entire island and leaving much of the island without fresh water, fuel, and phone service. In fact, many here on the mainland of the U.S. or on other areas of Puerto Rico have not heard from loved ones or friends a week later. Joining us is Hector Valdez, who is a producer at WLCH Radio in Lancaster, Spanish-speaking radio station Lancaster, who has relatives in Puerto Rico. Mr. Valdez, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Good morning to your listener.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. So, Hector, your relatives, tell me about your family members in Puerto Rico. Where are they? Have you heard anything yet?
My family is from the south part of the island, where I grew up also. And finally, yesterday, I have some phone calls from my nieces down there in Puerto Rico. The way they're doing it is they're traveling from the south part into the central part of the island, where some cellular antennas built there, and they trying to look for signal. And that's the way they have contact with us here at the United States.
Is everyone okay?
No. Oh. In my family, yes, but there's a lot of loss there. Some of them lost their houses and some properties. Fortunately, they don't lose their life, but there's a lot of damages down there.
Well, I just wondered, when I said, is everyone okay, I meant physically. I mean, I was going to get on to what they said, but physically, everyone is okay?
They're okay.
Okay. All right. So what did they describe to you some of the damages that they've seen?
Well, back in my hometown, they said that all the properties that was built by wood and zinc, everything is lost down there. Everything. Even some houses that was built with brick and cement lost parts of the earth.
Oh, it's just hard to imagine. I mean, we finally have seen some video from Puerto Rico in the last few days, and I heard a story on NPR this morning that one of the reporters talked about flying into San Juan, that everything normally is, you know, lush and green, and now everything is brown. I imagine that's what the whole island looks like. What were some of the stories that you were told by your nieces?
They said that when that hurricane started, who was like a monster, a terrible sound. They said some of the river get out and flood everything, businesses. A lot of all the houses was lost down there, and a lot of people nervous still. No water in some areas. The whole island is without electricity, with the exception of some hospitals that now are getting back the electricity, but there's a lot of damage down there.
Yeah, you mentioned water, that fresh water is a real problem. Understand that fuel, the gasoline, is hard to come by as well. And, you know, there are many parts of the island that people are using gasoline, not for car purposes, but to power their generators so that they do have some power. And I was finally glad to hear that, you know, there was some communication. Was this, you said that your relatives had to travel to get a signal. So I assume that you're talking about a cell phone.
Yes. There's some tower that was not damaged by the hurricane, but they had to travel like hour and a half or two to that area. Then they trying to look for signal, and they had signal for probably 5-10 minutes, and we lost the communication again. But yesterday I had some communications with my nieces.
I know that last week, that when we arranged your appearance on the program, that I was told that you were scared, that you were very, very worried about what was going on. So getting those phone calls must have been a big relief.
Definitely. It was like, oh, my God, thanks, Lord. And for the listeners that probably hasn't related down there, if they receive a phone call from another town that is not their hometown, they should answer it, because those antennas are probably at the north of the island, or maybe the southern part of the island, and coming probably from Caguas or Bayamon. Please answer those calls, because there's a phone call from your relatives down there.
So what you're talking about is on caller ID, if something shows up from Puerto Rico, if you have relatives in Puerto Rico, that even if you don't recognize it, it's something you should answer.
Yes. Hmm.
What about fresh water? You mentioned that your family was having some issues with that. Are they getting water anywhere?
They're getting water. FEMA is finally helping those that probably can make it to the north part of the island, and they're getting some water. But there's a lot of need down there. We're gonna have an event this Saturday here with the Red Cross. We're going to be collecting probably water and money to send to the people in Puerto Rico.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, let's face it, Mother Nature has not been kind. The last month or so, we had Harvey, we had Irma, and now Maria. Florida was devastated. Some areas of Florida, the Keys, and maybe up the west coast of Florida, Houston, Texas, the Gulf Coast with Harvey, a lot of flooding. I hate to say it, but it seems as though maybe it's just because it's only been a week and it's on the heels of those others, but Puerto Rico isn't getting as much attention.
I think it's because of the size of the devastation that we have down there. Scott, is big. It's the whole island. 3.5 million people without electricity, and thousands without their houses. They lost everything.
When you said, Hector, that you know, water, and we've heard with the previous hurricanes that the Red Cross has said, you know, what the best thing you can do, it's not just the Red Cross, but other organizations as well, have said that the best thing you can do if you want to help is to provide cash, because cash can go to the local economy and buy some of these products. But when you are low on water and you've lost everything, is this a case where they need more than just cash?
Definitely. They need water, they need food, because remember, some of the supermarkets, the places where they can go and buy stuff, are no longer there. They have some damages, and we have some pictures and videos from there that some of those bigger supermarkets are gone. So they need water, they need food, they need probably clothing, they need probably tarp, cover whatever was left after the hurricane.
You know, something else that you mentioned when you were describing your family traveling to about an hour away or so that they were able to get cell phone service. I just wonder what the roads are like. I had heard a report yesterday that even a week later, that there were people on the island who had not communicated with other family members or friends on the island, let alone here in the United States. What did they say about travel? I mean, how difficult was that?
It's very difficult, and it's dangerous also, because I don't know if you have that information, that some of the dams there are going to collapse soon, because there's so much flooding in the island. So it's probably a place where you can get in an hour. It'll probably take you 2.5 hours to get there, because some roads have been closed or there's some type of damages on the bridges. They had to take another area to get into the city where they can get signal.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Hector Valdez. He's a producer at WLCH Radio in Lancaster, Spanish-speaking station, also can be heard in York as well. He has relatives in Puerto Rico, finally heard from them yesterday. I want to talk a little bit more about what can be done to help the people of Puerto Rico. If you have a question or a comment, we have a few minutes left. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call, or send an email to smarttalk@WITF. Also, on Facebook, you can leave a message, a comment, or a message or a question on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that's 1-800-729-7532. So, Hector, talk about this event that you have planned. Who has this event planned, and what is it? What are they looking for?
We're looking for, so right now, money. The Red Cross will be on that day, as will be on Saturday. They're going to be collecting cash or check or credit card.
Where will this be?
It's going to be at Tech Centro. It's part of our mother organization, SACA, Hispanic American Civic Association. We're going to be there from 8 to 4 p.m. this coming Saturday with American Red Cross.
And I know that there are other cities. Harrisburg has one planned as well. Let's take a phone call from Juan in Harrisburg. Let me see. Is Juan on the air here? Hold on. Juan, are you there?
You know,
hey,
functioning Juan, because
Juan, are you there?
Situation.
Hey, Juan, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, so, yeah, my question. Hi, guys. My question is, we just got word from our family in Puerto Rico this past Friday. Luckily, so far, everyone is doing good, you know, under the circumstances. But my question was regarding the situation in the hospitals. I do have family members with conditions, one in particular with severe COPD, and because of the power issue and also not being a lot of gasoline to run generators, is having a lot of difficulty with his COPD. The hospitals are at capacity. Most of them are not, you know, providing the care that they would normally be able to provide. So my question was, you know, what course of action is FEMA or some of the other emergency agencies taking in order to address these problems to help people that are suffering from severe conditions, you know, in the meantime.
All right, Juan, thank you very much for your call. Hector, I don't know whether that's something you can answer or not. Do you have information on that?
Yes, I'll have a little bit of information on that. What I learned this morning is that the U.S. Marines is there providing generators to hospital, especially to the Centro Medico, which is the main hospital in the island, and they're providing with electric plants there. Marines is there, FEMA is there, and so understand that they're sending some more help down there from the United States.
It sounds as if hospitals, nursing homes, those kind of places where people are vulnerable, that is a priority for FEMA. As you mentioned, the Marines there at a hospital, sounds like that's a priority.
Yes, that's a priority right now.
So, Hector Valdez, we only have about 30 seconds left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I'm glad to hear that your family members are at least physically okay. Sounds like I have a lot of work to do. What kind of advice or what would you ask of our listeners to help the people of Puerto Rico?
Please help through the American Red Cross. Please help through FEMA. Please help. Puerto Rico is in need right now, and I know there's a lot of great hearts here in the United States. Thank you.
Hector Valdez is a producer at WLCH Radio in Lancaster. He has relatives in Puerto Rico. Hector, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, just the hurricanes over the past month just devastated the areas. I mean, Puerto Rico is just one of the islands that has been hit hard, other areas in the Caribbean as well. Coming up on tomorrow's program, ways to stop child sexual abuse and trafficking. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support for this program comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a valuable and trusted resource for the communities we serve. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to research that improves health, reduces recovery times, and brings new treatments and therapies to our area before they're available elsewhere. More information is at upmcpinnacle.com.